Hi everyone, I'm Gary Noll. Once again, we're going to be sharing a lot of insights on how we can live a longer and healthier life. This study comes from Tufts University, and it talks about how the more vitamin D that you consume, that's going to lower your risk of diabetes, especially if you're pre-diabetic. Now, we have probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 60 million Americans who are pre-diabetic. And the risk factors are being overweight, especially if you're obese, and also if you have high blood pressure, then there's a pretty good chance that you're going to end up pre-diabetic. But people don't go in and check their blood. People generally don't go in and check their blood pressure either. Blood sugar, blood pressure, you got to check both. So when you add in the diabetics that are being treated, and you add in all the people who are with high blood pressure who are being treated, then you add in all the people with high blood pressure who have not been treated, and all the pre-diabetics who have not been treated, you're dealing with literally 100 million Americans and more. It just puts you at greater risk of dying. So a review and meta-analysis published in the Annals of Internal Medicine found a 15% lower risk of developing type 2 diabetes among pre-diabetic men and women who received vitamin D supplements. The researchers analyzed data from three randomized trials that examined the effect of vitamin D on the risk of type 2 diabetes. I think they had around 4,000 participants who met the criteria for pre-diabetes, meaning hemoglobin A1C, fasting glucose, and impaired glucose tolerance. And they were using a placebo or 20,000 units of vitamin D per week. Now, that was about 4,000 units of vitamin D3 per day. And that's a good amount. Certainly, that's not what I would suggest if you were coming down with COVID or a serious infection. But for our purposes, for maintenance, a healthy health diet, that's fine. Now, so it's that simple, and we could help a lot of pre-diabetic people prevent from becoming diabetic. Also, you rarely hear about carpal tunnel syndrome, but the Cesares University of Medical Sciences found that chamomile oil, you've heard of the chamomile flower, back in the 1970s, it was the de-stress tea that people consume, chamomile. Well, research reveals that topical, meaning just rub it on, chamomile oil can have a positive effect for those experiencing pain from carpal tunnel syndrome. It's a natural and easily obtained substance. Chamomile oil could prove to be an inexpensive option for those suffering from the common ailment. All right, by the way, chamomile is an ancient flower. It's an ancient herb. It's been used to treat a variety of ailments. And this is something new. So, good. Rather see you use something new and natural that works, that turns off inflammation because it has strong antioxidant, anti-inflammatory properties. And when you can turn off inflammation, you reduce swelling, and that reduces pain. So just something to suggest. Now also, something I focused on a lot. This is from the University of California, Riverside. Acts of kindness can make you happier. And I'll bet all of you have experienced this. Performing even small acts of kindness and gratitude can make people happier. But how this occurs is more of a puzzle. And a professor of psychology at the University of California has studied happiness for more than 20 years. And she and others know that positive activities boost positive emotions. And also, your thoughts are improved and your behaviors improved. That in turn means your overall health and well-being is improved. I remember when I was watching a film, and here was a monkey, a small monkey, and this monkey loved all these animals on the farm. So every day when the monkey woke up, and the owner filmed this, the monkey was, monkeys sleep under blankets. They like to get under the blankets. And you see this little, see the little hands come up, little fingers, and pulls it down. These big eyes are looking out at the world. A new day. So the monkey gets up, and has some food, and then puts on this apron, and then goes around and starts feeding the other animals. Now, it's a hoot. She's feeding the puppies and the kittens, and then the chickens and the ducks, and she's hugging the ducks, and all the animals love her, and she's just having a ball. You watch that, and you just feel so good to see this. Also, there was a film clip from about 5 years ago, and it was of a guy wanted to see what would happen if you gave a homeless person some money. And so he gave this homeless person some money. I think it was $100. Then he went across the street, and he got into his van, and he was filming us. Well, the guy was right beside a liquor store. So he goes in the liquor store, and he's in there for a while, and he comes out, and he's got a shopping cart, and it's filled with bags. So he goes across the street to a park, and he starts giving out the bags, which contained food and toiletries, to the other homeless people. He didn't even keep one for himself. And you think, wow. I mean, think of that. You have nothing. You're homeless. You're on the street. Nobody wants you around them. I can tell you that from living on the Upper West Side. In fact, it was interesting. One day I was going into Riverside Park to do my work out in the morning. And there was a gentleman there who says, reading New York Times and having some kind of beverage. And he said, "Hi, Gary." And I stopped and said, "Hi." And it turns out this person's a top executive at Lincoln Center. And he lived across the street. He said every morning he likes to come out when the weather permits and read the New York Times and have his herbal tea. And so we had a little chat. And I said, "Did you ever see the homeless people in the park here?" He said, "No, but I do know they have to be out of sight by 7 o'clock. That's because when all the other people living on the Upper West Side go to the park to run." And I said, "Well, I see them all the time because I frequently come out at 5, 6 o'clock, and there's a toilet and a water, a little water faucet down as on the road that goes down by the river. And that's where the bikers and runners go. And so you'll see in the morning a long line of these people, generally guys from South America, and they got their backpack, and they'll walk one at a time up, and they'll brush their teeth, and they'll wash under their arms and their chest and their face. And there's a bathroom there they can use. And then they're supposed to disappear. And then they go up and they try to find work. And I always take extra money with me. And for years I would give them a little card and says free breakfast. And I've given the address where I'd already paid for the breakfast, and they can go and have a healthy breakfast. They were always very quiet, and they were surprised. And give them a little money, so no matter what they have to do that day, at least they have enough money to get someplace or to buy themselves something. Because my philosophy is, you have a gift, you give the gift. It's just the way normal people respond. And we had this conversation, and he says, "Doesn't it tell us something?" His words, he said, "Here we're living on what is arguably the most concentrated place on earth as far as intellects, successful people, high standards of living, and what is supposed to be a true liberal philosophy of life. And yet," because he hadn't seen this, he said, "you're telling me that these liberal, positive, successful people don't want people who are not successful to upset their view of their environment." I said, "It's absolutely correct. It's true." And it was just a passing comment to a person. And I'm thinking, but how much better you feel when you do help another human being, even in a small way. And I think that's important. And that's what this study, that's what this professor of psychology at the University of California found. The more things you can do, even if they're minor things, you're boosting your happiness to kindness level in your life. And then you get used to it. Then you look forward to doing things for people. You know, and that's important too, because we have a lot of people who could use some kindness. And by doing that, you're going to feel happy. All right? And as a society, I believe we have a lot of decent people, a lot of people who understand, especially older people, especially our parents, if they're still alive, who went through the Great Depression, where they had to rely upon the benefit of strangers helping them out. Because we are now faced in our society with over 200 million Americans out of a country of 340 million who cannot write you a check for $500, who are imbued in debt and no way out, not with our current political system of creating debt and profiting from it. So do something kind for others and see how you feel about it. I just think it's a good idea. I'm glad they did this study, but I don't think we need a study to tell us how good we feel, especially if people can show gratitude and appreciation. From Duke University comes a study about looking at yoga and on how yoga could impact major psychiatric disorders. Now, we all know that yoga has positive effects on mild depression and sleep complaints, even in the absence of drug treatments, and it improves symptoms associated with ADHD in patients on medications. That's according to the review of the actual scientific literature. This was published in the open access journal Frontiers in Psychiatry, and it looked at over 100 different studies on high quality effects of yoga, helping people overcome depression, even schizophrenia, ADD, sleep complaints, eating disorders, and cognitive problems. It benefits all that. Wow. One more reason that people should employ this 5,000-year-old Indian practice, because according to even orthodox psychiatry, it is, quote, highly promising. You bet it's highly promising. As is, by the way, talk therapy. Drug therapy? No. Talk therapy? Yes. And one other study here, and this is about Qigong. That's Qigong. I remember when I was doing a documentary 20 years ago on natural approaches to stress, either depression or anxiety. And I went around to all the people who were having good success, including one I'd never done before on rebirthing, it's called, and where, in effect, the person is going through this rebirthing process at the emotional level with the person that's experienced in it, and all the epigenetic negatives they're leaving behind, so a person's entering into a repurposed mindset. And I saw it work. I followed people up for a year. Have you fallen back? No, I feel great. Where before, for decades, they had this constant existential angst and adversely affect the quality of their life. But when I went to the Qigong person, who was from South Korea, and he had been in a family of Qigong practitioners for generation after generation, I had a lot of friends who wanted to come with me, three physicians amongst them. And I said, you just have to be very quiet, can't ask questions, we're on a film set. So we're in the guy's office, and I took someone that had specific problems that no one in the room knew about. I did. And so the man, he had the man lie on a table, and this Qigong master came over, and he did a little meditation, and he rubbed his hands together, and then he put the hands up and down the man's body, and then he stopped at one particular area. And I said to the person who was on the table, what do you feel? He said, extreme heat. Now, the guy's hand was probably about 10 inches above the guy's body. So I simply took my hand and put it between the Qigong hand and the patient. And wow, it felt like I just put it into an oven. I mean, real heat. And I'd never experienced that before. I'd never experienced Qigong before. Knew about it, never. And sure enough, when the man was finished, he explained what he saw was out of balance with the energy. And sure enough, that's exactly the area that the person had the problems with. And the person had extreme diverticulitis. And he was right there. Of all the places in the body, he was right at the intestine. And the person said he felt amazing. And about 2 weeks later, when he had another physical exam, they couldn't determine any of the gastrointestinal problems, including diverticulitis. So I've seen what these energy therapies can do. I've tested them in the laboratory. I used to have all the time. Aside from the 165 experiments I did in health and nutrition in the anti-aging division of the Institute of Biology, where I was a senior research fellow, I did Psi research. Now, the director allowed me to do the Psi research, providing that I was told they would not be submitting any papers for peer review publication. It was not to be discussed. Fine. Because it was just a lot of, when you get a lot of orthodox people, they can't appreciate what happens when people have energy that's out of balance or those who can rebalance energy. But all over the country, people would come there, professors, all kinds of, Stanley Krippner, very famous man, came there, Dr. Douglas Dean and Dr. Thomas Carruth, all these people would come because they wanted to have a place where they could do quality scientific validation to see does it work or not. I remember there was a guy named Flanagan. I think he just passed last year. He did the pyramid power and how if you looked in the Great Pyramid, you saw that the dead rats that lived in the pyramid were mummified but not rotted. And that you could keep a razor blade sharp by putting it in the pyramid, etc. Well, I took pyramids that I built or some I bought, small ones, and that I could fit in on a table. And we did that, razor blades. I cut my face all up. That didn't work. And we had a lot of dead rats downstairs, and they all rotted. None were mummified. So I contacted him. I said, you know, we've done 16 experiments, and all 16 failed. So from my perspective, I can no longer in any way support that the pyramid power is what you and others are advocating, you know, based upon me trying to duplicate in the lab. Anyhow, but there were a lot of things we did prove. And the single most important thing we proved was that rebalancing a person's energy can definitely help in the healing process. And we saw that with acupuncture. We saw it with chiropractic. We saw it with reverse hypnosis. And I had a lot of scientists, Dr. Putterman, Dr. Harari, Dr. Lane Kahn, Dr. Donald Mullen. Several of these are my close personal friends, and they were up there all the time doing all kinds of experiments. Now, why do I give you this as background? Because the one thing we don't talk about in our society is the energy, the positive energy in an environment. The positive energy in food, positive energy in a person sharing something with us. When you share your story, and that's what most people do, they share their story. If that's a story where you're the victim, and always, and never responsible for doing anything wrong, the energy is just really negative. It's out of balance. And I'll tell you how, without doing a laboratory experiment, how everyone has experienced this. How do you feel when you're around life that is full and vibrant? People, animals, puppies, kittens, things that are happy. You feel good. How do you feel when you're around people who are negative, depressed, toxic, angry, judgmental? You feel drained. Now imagine that you maladapt to someone because there's something you need in that relationship, but instead of saying, why do I need that in this relationship when I can have a relationship with someone who doesn't have the negative side, just the positive side? But that also shows how convinced we are that better the devil I know than the devil I don't, assuming everyone's got a toxic side, which is not true. There are loads of wonderful, balanced people. We're not talking about perfection, we're just talking about balanced people. They don't bring their negativity and focus it on getting you convinced that their story is right and they're a victim and you have to hear the story 1,000 times. Whatever advice you give them, they're not going to take it in any case. And they just, and you just feel drained. I don't have those people in my life. People have problems, let's work on the problem. If you don't want the problem to go away, then I'm the wrong person to be around. But a lot of people don't want the problem because their whole identity comes from being a victim. Because what do you not expect from a victim? Anything. All right? What do you expect from people who are happy, have ideas and engaging? You expect them to do things. You expect to have some positive outcomes. So Qigong, coming back Qigong, Qigong could determine where there's an imbalance in the life flow, the energy, and correct it. Now, I'm not talking about someone who teaches Qigong. I'm talking about an authentic practitioner. Here's the University of Texas at MD Anderson Cancer Center, one of the most respected cancer centers in the world. Quote, Qigong improves quality of life for breast cancer patients. That's correct. The University of Texas MD Anderson have found Qigong, an ancient body-mind practice, reduces depressive symptoms and improves quality of life in women undergoing radiotherapy for breast cancer. This was published in the Peer Review Journal of Cancer, and it's the first to examine Qigong in patients actively receiving radiation therapy, include a follow-up period to assess the benefits over time. All right. Now, here's a question for MD Anderson. Have you done the following? Have you tried to treat patients with advanced cancer without radiation or chemotherapy, but only using things such as high-dose vitamin C, intravenous ozone, a bitter melon, and other therapies that have been shown in those doctors, including oncologists, who have no longer held to just the protocols within the orthodox establishment? Because now it's like saying, take our drug and we will overcome your problem. But look at the bottom of every single ad, and it says, in combination with a healthy diet, exercise, and lifestyle. Well, how do we know it wasn't a healthy diet, lifestyle, and exercise that was the principal cause of reducing symptoms or improving the person's condition? So they can promote the drug, but not the lifestyle intervention, because there's no way to patent, there's no money in it. So I'm glad that MD Anderson did this study, but I'd like to see them do studies or even interview people who've had reversal of end-stage cancers with no chemotherapy or radiation, and then see if they can duplicate it using the same protocols. Just a thought. But for all of you who have problems and you have not had solutions, find a person engaged in Qigong who has long experience, and you can feel it. I mean, you literally can feel it when you're doing it. And finally, from the University of Michigan, endocrine disrupting chemicals, what are called EDCs, these are the phthalates, they increase your risk if you're a woman of diabetes. This was published in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. By the way, these are used in plastics, personal care products, children's toys, food and beverages, and packaging. So that's one more reason, before you bring something into your house, ask, is there a safer way of me dealing with this? We just have too much plastic in our lives. And people are using plastic containers to heat up their food in a microwave. The microwave shouldn't be in anyone's home. And they're dangerous. They disrupt the DNA of the cells of the food that you're heating up. So that's just another lesson to learn. Make your home toxic free. Get rid of the carpets, because that's where a lot of mold and danders exist. When you're doing your laundry, do it without the bleach or toxic chemicals, because that can cause forms of eczema on the body, little patches. Try to use only natural materials, also for the towels, everything else. And put in a high-quality air filter, one that has five-stage filtration. filtration that can get down to below a 1 micron. That means you're getting rid of the viruses, bacteria, danders, molds, particulate matter in the air. You don't want to breathe in, all right? Just try to live a more sanitary life in your work and home environment. That'll help you. And don't use the aluminum skillets or pots for cooking, because the high temperature, particulate matter of that aluminum breaks off, goes in the food or beverage, you get it in the body, and you play heck trying to get it out of the body. It can disrupt your neurological function, your central nervous system, and it can contribute to cancer. Just live a more natural life. Use stainless steel. Use things that do not shed off. That's the latest on health and healing. And today, on our Classroom on the Air, which is up on Rumble and GaryNall.com, I did a segment on getting off the grid, getting off their grid, so that you can make better choices in life. Support that which is healthy and healing and honest, instead of the lies and the biases. I went through about 35 minutes on just that one. Every day I put another Classroom on the Air up. I don't shed on this because we have a packed program. And these are free, but you can get them over there. And we'll give you more every single day. Always new information, new insights. PRN.live. All right? We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. We are spending over $100 billion on a war that we shouldn't be supporting, but we created. Go clear back to 2014. The second most powerful woman in Washington, D.C., outside of the president's wife, is Gloria Nuland, her and her husband. These are neocons. These are warmongers. And she was in perfect company with Hillary Clinton, who ran the State Department. She was second in command, and she's second in command now. And she, along with the deep state, created a coup in Ukraine. They got rid of the democratically elected politician as president, and they put in their own puppets. And then they went after Russia. They went after the Russian-speaking Ukrainians living in that area, the Donbass area. In any case, Putin repeatedly warned, stop this, and the media went after Putin, but not the fact that we created a coup. What is the real purpose, this whole Ukrainian conflict? It's to get Putin out of power and then try to balkanize Russia in order to steal its assets and control the whole region. They will fail. We just found out yesterday through the great work of Seymour Hersh, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, that he went into great detail, fine minutia, of explaining how the Biden administration blew up the gas line that was going from Russia into Germany. Boy, did that cause problems. We denied that we did it, and yet now it's proof we did it. We just can't seem to do anything right on our policies. There's a professor who has been right from the beginning on this. You never see him in the mainstream media. Let's go to his clip right now. You're going to hear the truth about Russia and Ukraine and the conflict, possibly for the first time.
Okay, let's shift gears and go to Europe and talk about what's going on in Ukraine. And here we're focusing mainly on the U.S.-Russian dyad. It is very important to understand that the Americans drive the train in the West. Putin doesn't want to talk to the Europeans. He wants to talk to the Americans. He knows who the boss is. Right? So when you think about the war in the Ukraine, it's really the U.S. and the Russians that matter the most, in addition to the Ukrainians, of course. Now, the conventional wisdom in the West is that what is happening here is that Putin is an imperialist, and he is bent on creating a greater Russia were recreating the Soviet Union. And what he is intent on doing in Ukraine is conquering that country, occupying that country, and integrating it into a greater Russia. And in fact, Ukraine is the first stop on the train line. When he's done with Ukraine, he's going to move on to other states like Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, maybe Poland, who knows. But he is an imperialist at heart. He's an aggressor who's interested in building an empire. This is the conventional wisdom that you all know well. I would imagine that most of you believe this. My view is this is simply wrong. There's no evidence to support it. I believe that if you're going to make that argument, you have to show evidence that Putin said it was desirable to conquer Ukraine and create a greater Russia. You have to show evidence that he thought it was feasible to do that. And you have to show evidence that he said that that's what he was doing. There is no evidence, and I want to underline that word, no. There is no evidence that he thought it was desirable to conquer Ukraine or to create a greater Russia or to conquer any other country. There's no evidence that he thought it was feasible. And there's no evidence that he said that's what he was doing. Furthermore, he does not have the capability to do it. The Russians invaded Ukraine with 190,000 men. There's no way 190,000 men could conquer a piece of real estate with 40 plus million people in it with 190,000 men. When the Germans invaded Poland in 1939, they went in with 1.5 million men. You need a huge army to conquer a country like Ukraine, occupy it, and incorporate it into your country. And you're not going to do that with 190,000 men. Furthermore, this man, Vladimir Putin, does not have the Wehrmacht at his fingertips. You've noticed how poorly the Russian army performs. So you have a small army that's not the Wehrmacht. There's no way this army could conquer all of Ukraine. And if you look at the strategy that's been employed, my argument makes perfect sense. This is not a case of Putin acting like an imperialist. My argument is, as I'm sure many of you know, that if you look carefully at what was going on, it's quite clear that the West's efforts to turn Ukraine into a Western bulwark on Russia's borders was viewed as an existential threat. The brightest of all red lines, as Bill Burns, the ambassador, U.S. ambassador to Moscow at the time said, by the entire Russian elite. The idea that Ukraine was going to be incorporated into NATO, the idea that Ukraine was going to be incorporated into the EU, the idea that you were going to promote an orange revolution and turn Ukraine into a pro-Western liberal democracy, it's unacceptable to the Russians. It was an existential threat. You might not think it was an existential threat, but what you think doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is what the Russians think. And the Russians thought it was an existential threat. And they made it unequivocally clear to us that it was an existential threat. And how did we react? We ignored what they said and we continued pushing to bring Ukraine into NATO. Pushing to bring Ukraine into the EU, pushing to turn it into a pro-Western liberal democracy. Why did we do that? I'll tell you why we did it, because the Russians were weak. That's what happens when you're weak in international politics. The Russians protested NATO expansion from the get-go. The first tranche took place in 1999. The second tranche of expansion took place in 2004, right? The Russians screamed bloody murder both times. We didn't care. We just shoved it down their throat. They were weak. And when they're weak, you can do that. 1990, 2009, we succeeded. 2004, we succeeded. Then in 2008, we said, we're going to bring Georgia and Ukraine into NATO. The Russians made it very clear, you're not going to do that. You're not going to do that. We're going to resist. And if we have to, we'll destroy Ukraine. This was clear a long time ago. What did we do? We doubled down. We just kept pushing and pushing and pushing. And what you want to understand is that from the Russian perspective, this is an existential threat. They have to win this war. They cannot afford to lose it. If you accept the argument that Putin is an imperialist and he's just bent on conquering some more territory and creating a greater Russia, and there's no really underlying security imperative, then you can cut a deal and end this war. But if you think that the Russians view this as an existential threat, you think about this conflict in very different ways. Because you're dealing with a great power that's armed to the teeth with thousands of nuclear weapons that sees itself facing an existential threat. Now, that's my view of the Russian perspective on how this has to end. They have to win. They cannot afford to lose. What is American policy and what is Ukrainian policy? American policy is we're going to beat them in Ukraine. This is, of course, Western policy. Norway is deeply involved in this. Our policy is to defeat the Russians, right? And also wreck their economy with sanctions. And also promote regime change and then put Putin on trial. And maybe even break apart Russia. This is their goal. We're going for victory. We think we can win in Ukraine. Putin has to win. We think we can win. And the Ukrainians, it's an open and shut case. Of course, from their point of view, they want to recover all their territory. And they want to weaken Russians as much as possible so that Russia can't pay a return visit. So the Russians are pursuing a clear-cut victory. The Ukrainians and the Americans are pursuing a clear-cut victory. What does this tell you? This tells you there's no diplomatic solution. There's no diplomatic solution to this one. This is why everybody basically understands that this is going to be a protracted stalemate, right? Or at least they think it's going to be a protracted stalemate. They think it's going to be a protracted stalemate because there's no solution. There's another dimension to this, the most worrisome of all, and that's nuclear escalation. Russia thinks it faces an existential threat. And again, what you think doesn't matter. It's what the Russians think. They think they face an existential threat. What happens if NATO succeeds? What happens if we begin to roll the Russian army back in Ukraine? And we're moving up to the borders of Russia. When I say we, I'm talking about Ukrainian forces backed by NATO power. The Russians are likely to use nuclear weapons to rescue the situation, right? This is a great power that's facing an existential threat and it's losing. You don't think it's going to think seriously, at least, about using its nuclear weapons? You can rest assured it is. I like to tell the story.
You see, in the mainstream media doesn't carry any of this information. Now we're going to go to another clip. Someone who has just got an abundance of common sense. And he is one of the best historians, but also philosophers. And he's doing all this extemporaneously. So I really appreciate Neil Oliver. Let's hear from him now.
The 77th Brigade, that bit of military intelligence that's supposed to keep its eye on the enemy, has been keeping its eye on us. That's nice, isn't it? The overarching idea is that the government, as it has been revealed, in the biggest inverted commas you can find, it's been revealed that during lockdown, during that whole 3 year cluster bleep, they were watching people who were arguing with them. They were watching people who were offering up contrary points of view, dissenters. Now, I'm being cynical about it being a surprise for obvious reasons, because none of it is a surprise for those of us who were out there in the trenches asking questions about lockdown and everything else. We knew all along, we knew from practically the beginning, that anyone speaking up, asking questions about the virus, about the lockdowns and everything else, we knew that people were being shadow banned, cancelled, they were being ridiculed, they were being demonised, their colleagues and workmates were being invited to look on them as pariah. We knew that. And yes, at the same time, we knew that we were being watched by the authorities. You know, people's content was being taken down. People were being driven from their jobs. And all of that. And at the same time, we knew that our voices were being paid attention to, and that people, certain people, journalists, people speaking out, doctors, various people from all walks of life were had their names on the list. Don't tell them your name, Pike. You know, we were being watched by the authorities, and everybody knew it. So there's no surprise in it. I mean, for one reason, there's so many reasons why it wasn't a surprise. I've spoken about this recently. We live in a zero trust world now. Now, that zero trust is not the appellation that I'm applying. If you look into the work that's being done to establish the framework, to raise the scaffolding of the brave new world, of the Great Reset, they themselves, those architects, apply the term zero trust. The idea being that in the future, when we've all had our digital IDs forced upon us, you will exist in a state where you are guilty until you prove yourself innocent. The authorities, the online world, the gatekeepers of that brave new world, will regard you as a criminal, every one of us, unless and until you can prove that you're a goodie. And the only way you'll be able to do that is with your digital ID. So that if you don't accept your digital ID and use it, you will remain identified as a baddie, as a potential criminal, as someone who deserves zero trust. That's the reality. So we've gone from being people who are, if you like, presumed innocent until proven guilty. The whole thing is being inverted in the future. That we'll be guilty, we'll be fraudsters, we'll be hackers, we'll be not who we say we are. Anything negative you can think about, that's the way in which we will be regarded, unless and until we can prove the difference. And that will be by submitting to this digital identification. It was all there in the word choice lockdown. I noticed lockdown at the time, you know, when the politicians started talking about it. It registered, you know, it was like something that I swallowed, and on the way down it hurt. But I didn't think about it properly. I just noticed it. But gradually, though, I realised it was prison parlance. Lockdown is what prison authorities do within a prison. If they even sniff the possibility of a revolt, of a rebellion, of trouble, they lock down all the prisoners. So even if they suspect that maybe just two or three are proposing to start trouble, they lock down 1,000 people. So that was interesting to me once I started thinking about it, interesting to put it mildly, that they were using prison language. And why were they using prison language? Because that's how they see us, and that's how they want to treat us, as criminals who need to be in digital chains in case any of us decide to do anything. So you're convicted in advance, thought crime, anything you might do, you're better just lock them down, even if they're innocent. Just lock them in their cells. And now we know that no less than the British Army, no less than military intelligence was being applied against us. you know, that files were being kept, that tweets were being read, you know, and presumably some kind of score put against them from, you know, from 0 to 10 as, you know, potential troublemaker. And this was going on while millions of people were being tricked. And I say that because some of the same DNA, some of the same genetics that was in the you know, 77th Brigade and whatever else was used to keep an eye on us, was there in the nudge units anyway. You know, we know that psychological techniques, psyops, were being applied to try and get the mass of the population to do things, to behave in a certain way. It was propaganda by any other name. And millions of people were tricked into thinking things like, we're all in it, we're all in danger. Danger, danger. And also, we're all in it together. You know, from the queen down to the lowliest serf, we're all in it together and we've all got to do our bit. So this was what was being pushed. And yet, so many of us could see plainly that was not what was actually the case. That, you know, that politicians and our leaders were having parties, you know, and having drinking sessions together behind closed doors because they weren't afraid, because they knew there was nothing to be afraid of. So all of the breaches that subsequently came to light, birthday cake this, you know, Winegate that, once you looked at it with that cynical eye, you realised that everything was just about control of us, the little people, control imposed by these mini tyrants. And when it wasn't as subtle as propaganda, it was just outright oppression by overmighty police and other myrmidons of the state. You know, and when you know, everything was being used to keep us under control. So it's in that context that learning that the military intelligence, you know, sanctioned by the Cabinet Office, was keeping record of anybody who's speaking up. It's hardly surprising, you know, that confirmation that we were being watched, that files were being kept. To me, that just underlines what I thought and said for the longest time, that none of it was about public health and it was all about control. That's all it was about. They weren't frightened because they knew there was nothing to be frightened of, which is why they kept mixing, which is why they didn't social distance, which is why, you know, they were in each other's company, unmasked and all the rest of it, you know, because it was about control. And, you know, what's deeply disturbing, you know, now we've got this information, now we know that the way in which we were being treated and regarded and the techniques that were being used to keep an eye on us, those who seized control were demonstrably wrong about everything, but they don't care. That's what's really harrowing. They don't care because by the application of their misinformation and their propaganda, they got the control that they wanted and they've still got it now. So you know, you pull back from it and you look around. Look at what's happened at the same time. You know, if you know that game you play with a cat with a torch, you know, where you put the circle on the wall or on the floor, the cat jumps at it. Bright thing. Oh, moved. Bright thing. That's what they were doing with COVID, with climate crisis, with war in Ukraine, the whole 15-minute cities. Look over there. Look, COVID. War in Ukraine. Well, climate crisis, right? So they were playing with us. And while they had us distracted, everything else happened. Online harms bill, you know, the one that's going to take away freedom of speech. Legislation that's going to make it illegal to strike, more legislation to make it impossible for public protest, the 15-minute cities already mentioned, the climate crisis, which is the biggest hoax in history. It's all about maintaining control. Keep the people jittery, take control. And now it's digital IDs, as I say, and that's going to finally slam the digital cage shut. The cage is made of central bank digital currencies and mandatory procedures and goodness knows what else. And if you're worried now about the surveillance that was put in place to keep an eye on us, if you were worried about what happened in the past, it is as nothing compared to the surveillance that's going to be possible with the digital ID. That whole digital framework is going to mean that moment by moment, they will have visibility of everything we do and everywhere we go, everyone we meet, everyone we talk to, what we say when we're together, the whole works. Will be surveyed all the time, 24 hours a day, forever. So that, you know, the confirmation that the 77th Brigade and the surveillance of... Confirmation that the 77th Brigade and the surveillance of...
That's... We're going to go to a clip one. That's part one of Neil Oliver. Part two will be tomorrow. Now I'm going to go to a clip. This is a clip of a woman who says she gets calls every day of people saying the same identical thing, and she's rightfully angry, extremely angry. But you'll never see her on television. You'll never see her being interviewed. You'll never see the New York Times or any of the reporters checking to see, was her father strapped down to a bed and forcibly given remdesivir, a drug that no one should ever have? It's never been on the market. It's toxic, kills people. And yet that's the primary drug people have been given. Let's hear what she has to say.
So, anybody heard about Kristen the Piston? Anybody heard about how my father was murdered with remdesivir? Has anybody heard about how the hospital called me and blamed me and my mom because we weren't vaccinated and that was the reason he died? Anybody heard about how they put my dad on palliative care and they never fed him and they starved him to death? And they only gave him one can of Ensure in 9 days? Anybody hear about that? Anybody hear about how they put my dad in bilateral restraints, restrained him against his will, and pumped him full of remdesivir against his and his family wishes while they called me and blamed me and told me he was dying because I wouldn't take the vaccine? Has anyone heard this story? Anyone? You heard this story yet? You heard about how my dad was murdered in a worse way than people on death row? Do you hear me? People on death row are treated more humanely than my father. He wasn't able to use a phone. Are you listening to me? Everybody, you know, people want me to act all nice. You! They murdered my father. They injected him with poison. They lied to me. They blamed me. You want me to act normal? Sit here and make videos like everything's okay? So we can watch Rebel News go up to Albert Bourla and do nothing? Nothing? Is that what you want?
Okay. Separate out her anger from what she is saying, and she's 100% correct. There are now millions of people who have been injured and documented injured, some with the lifetime injuries, and hundreds of thousands dead just in the United States. More Americans have died because of Anthony Fauci and the others insisting upon the rightness of their vaccine policies, their hospitalization policies, their quarantine policies, than all of Americans who were killed in Vietnam and the First World War combined. And yet, you wouldn't know that from any of the mainstream media or all of the individuals who sing the praises of the deep state. So this is a form where Lou Hill would say, yeah, Gary, put the voiceless on, even if they're shrill, because some people let you know what they think when they have no more things to lose. Something the American public can handle. You want to know how bad it is? Here's the latest. It's only a minute long. It'll go right up to BAI's news, maybe a little over. 3 million more disabled Americans, according to the latest report. That's 3 million in addition to all the others. Here is that report.
The disability data is also a disaster. And it's even, we're finding in our research that for every one excess death, there's four disabilities. Four people that get disabled and can't work. This chart is pretty simple. Focus on the colored area. When we break down what happened in the age group 16 to 64 since February of 21, we've added 3.2 million disabled Americans. It was hovering around 29 to 30 million prior 4 years. And in Wall Street, we focus on signals and frequency and rate of change. That was a 3 standard deviation year-over-year rate of growth change. Shouldn't have happened. So 3.2 million people in about 2 years have been disabled. When we delve into the numbers, half of those are employed, 1.7 million. When you look at the disability rate increases, 31% rate increase for employed, 8% for the general population. And when you look at this group is a smoking gun as far as I'm concerned, not in labor force. Those are the people who left. Those are the people who got fired and or quit. and their health outcomes have been the best. They've only had a 4% increase in the disability rate. So we've hit a new disability rate in the U.S. We're 10% higher than we were 2 years ago. It's 3.2 million people. These are real numbers. And if you're wondering why there's help wanted signs, this is it. And I said to Ron Johnson, Senator Ron Johnson, I'm saying it to everyone, this is a national security issue. But yet there's crickets from our health authorities and global governments, because this is occurring in every country. This is not just the U.S.
Okay, that's Mr. Ed Dowd. So what have we learned? We've learned that everything we were told is a lie, and that millions upon millions of Americans have been injured, many for life, and we still don't know how many more we end up having these self-organizing lipid nanoparticles clot their veins and arteries and kill them. But it's going to be a lot. Here's something else that just came in this morning that you probably are not aware of. And this is from Alex Berenson, who used to be an award-winning reporter for the New York Times. Quote, Dr. Anthony Fauci now admits the RNA COVID vaccine hardly work and might not be approvable. In fact, the bombshell paper he co-authored last month suggests all vaccines for common respiratory viruses may face intractable hurdles, and that's not even the worst news. I'm not exaggerating. Last month, three scientists pointed out flu shots barely work and couldn't be approved based upon the standards used for vaccines like measles. Quote, after more than 60 years of experience with influenza vaccines, very little improvement in vaccine prevention of infection has been noted. Our best approved influenza vaccines could be inadequate for licensure for most other vaccine preventable diseases, end quote. True, several vigorous papers have proven that flu shots are placebos masquerading as public policy. But the same scientists that compared our beloved and groundbreaking COVID vaccines to those pointless flu jabs, quote, as variant SARS-CoV-2 strains have emerged, deficiencies in these COVID vaccines reminiscent of influenza vaccines have become apparent. Just who are those vicious anti-vax rebels? Three researchers at the National Institutes of Health, including one whose name may ring a bell, now retired Dr. Anthony Fauci. Yet the COVID flu shot comparison is only one of the article's bombshells. At its core, the piece raises questions of whether any vaccine can ever work well enough to matter against bugs like common coronaviruses, influenza, and RSVs. And it goes on from there. Go to GaryNoll.com. Look under articles. Now look under vaccine articles. The most comprehensive set of scholarly articles written by myself and Richard Gale, fully documented and vetted, show you what I just read you. And this is over the last 15 years. There is no such thing as a safe and effective vaccine. And we prove all that. And this is now another door that is being opened, now that we've shown you the lies that we have been administered. We're out of time now. We don't have time for calls, sorry. But I just want to let you know that we are continuing to see this entire story change. So that's that. And by the way, tune in Saturdays at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on PRN.live for Maths Pass. If you bake, you can appreciate maths transformative properties. Admiring the stackable potato chips is to admire the hyperbolic sheet. Find out why there's no need to fear math. Math is not racist. You just need to think outside the cubic. Also, how nature's geometric shapes inspire the next generation of squishy robots, and an argument for radically overhauling math class. The endpoint of these common factors is acute in this program. So, great speakers, some of the best minds, some of the best mathematicians in the world. You can find that every Saturday, 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on PRN.live. Have a nice day, everyone.